Omaha Public Radio presents a program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear a lecture by Craig Dallin, Associate Dean and Professor of Law at Creighton University. His topic will be Copyrights and Free Use. Mr. Dallin's appearance was co-sponsored by the College of St. Mary Office of Academic Affairs. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, December 12, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Christine Farr, Vice President for Academic Affairs at the College of St. Mary.
I have the pleasure today of introducing our speaker, Craig Dallin, who informs me that he's a JD, not a doctor, so I won't refer to him as doctor. He is the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Law at Creighton University School of Law. He joined the faculty at Creighton in 2000, and he graduated from Brigham Young University with a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1986 and his Juris Doctor in 1991. Craig has served as executive editor of the BYU Law Review and has clerked for the Honorable James K. Logan on the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. He has significant experience that he has brought to his current position, having practiced law in Salt Lake City and taught at Appalachian School of Law and Brigham Young University. He writes and teaches in the areas of copyright law, trademark law, tort law, and professional responsibility. Please join me in welcoming Craig Dallin, our speaker.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction. And it's my pleasure to be here today. As Dr. Farr mentioned, I teach copyright law. And so any opportunity that I have to talk about copyrights is a great day for me, and I'm excited to do it. So I hope that we'll have a good discussion today. I always like to begin, and people think this is a little strange, but this is a lawyer thing. I always begin with a caveat, a little disclaimer, and I just tell you this. I'm not your lawyer. I'm not here to give legal advice to you. You have a lawyer probably at the college, and that's the person that you should seek your legal advice from. I'm not here to interfere with anything they might say. And I tell you that because, as we will discover in our conversation today, many of these copyright issues are very fact-specific and small details that you might think wouldn't really matter can matter. And that's why we always tell people you need to talk to your lawyer, set everything out carefully, let them have a chance to really look at it carefully if you need a legal determination. But what I am here to do today, and I'm happy to do, is to tell you some of the basics of copyright law and in particular, perhaps identify some areas that are of special interest to people in education so that you'll have a background and a foundation so you can make some of your own determinations, and also you'll know when there's issues that you need to raise with others and seek some information. I thought what we would do today is first I would start by talking about some basics of copyright law, after that speak specifically about some of the university and public education and higher education and private education issues that come up in copyright contexts. Now, I start out by talking about copyright basics for a couple of reasons. Usually when I speak to a group, there will be a real variety of folks. Some will have a lot of experience with copyrights, and they'll know a lot, and they really don't need a lot of my basic discussion because it's review for them. Others will know very little about copyright, and so they need some background. And then there's some folks in the middle who have some information about copyright law and principles, but they may have some misunderstandings as well that they don't even know they have, and so it's important to kind of cover what the law is, so that they can maybe correct some of those misconceptions. The other reason why it's important that we focus on the basics of copyright law as a start-off point is, as you will see when we talk about the fair use exception and some of the exceptions that apply in particular to educational institutions, you will find that the basic purposes of copyright law become important in those discussions and in making decisions about specific questions about, well, Can this be copied or can't this? Can this be performed or can't it? And often we have to fall back upon what the basic principles of copyright are and what copyright law is really trying to achieve to answer those questions. So that's kind of the game plan that I have for today. Now, I begin with an overall reminder about what is copyright all about, what is the purpose, and what are we after. Now, I'll tell you something that I'm sure I did not know when I went to law school. I didn't know about it until after I was out of law school. There's actually a clause in the United States Constitution which specifically addresses copyright. And most people wouldn't realize that. And it doesn't use the word copyright in that clause. That's one of the reasons why maybe we don't know it's there. But it is specific, and it does speak to copyrights. And that provision says, and I'm going to quote it to you here, "The Congress shall have power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries." Now, this provision applies not only to copyrights but also to patents. Sometimes it's called the Copyright Clause. Sometimes it's called the Intellectual Property Clause. But I mention this to you because we learn a couple of things from that clause. First of all, we learn that the founders of our country and the ratifiers of the Constitution, they were actually aware that there were issues. They were aware of copyright. They were aware of the need to have copyright protection, even way back 1790. And they were also aware, of course, of the need to protect patents and inventions. We also learn a little bit from the clause because it says to promote the progress of science and useful arts. It tells us what the founders and the ratifiers of the Constitution thought the purpose of copyright was. It's to promote the public interest. And so the way we promote the public interest, and Congress, right after the ratification of the Constitution, enacted legislation allowing copyright protection. The way that Congress achieves this goal of promoting the public interest is by creating incentives for people to create works. The theory is if you allow a limited monopoly for an author, then that will provide an incentive for the author to actually spend time and labor and effort to create their works. That way they have a hope that they can have some compensation for that. They can make a living creating works. And the consequence of that is, or the result is, that our society is improved and it's where there are more works available to us to enjoy. There are more books for us to read, more, you know, compositions for us to hear, and movies for us to see, and we all benefit as a result. And so the focus here, or the purpose, is we've got to create incentives to support the creation of works and ultimately to allow the public to have an opportunity to benefit from those works. Those are the underlying purposes of copyright law. Very important from the beginning to understand what copyright protects. The scope of copyright protection, when I say the scope, I mean my concern here is just what is protected, what things or what works, what creative efforts are protected and what aren't. That's where we might begin our discussion. So there is a statute, a federal statute that governs copyright law, and it tells us that original works of authorship, fixed, intangible mediums of expression, are entitled to copyright protection. Now, I'm going to tell you what all that means in a minute, but there are a couple of important things that you should know. One important thing you should know is that it doesn't matter if there's not a circle C or the word copyright on a work. That doesn't matter. It still is likely to be protected by copyright law. It also doesn't matter that the author has not filed anything, filed or registered their copyright with the Copyright Office. That's not required or necessary either. What works are protected? This is this language comes, again, from the Copyright Act, the federal statute which governs copyright law. Literary works, musical works, dramatic works, pantomimes and choreographic works, pictorial, graphic, and sculptural works, motion pictures and other audiovisual works, sound recordings, and even architectural works. And I'm going to give you some specifics. What that all boils down to, these are examples: books, maps, letters that you might write, plays, songs, both the lyrics and the music, paintings, sculptures, motion pictures, photographs, PowerPoint presentations, speeches, computer programs, ornamental belt buckles. There's actually a case on that. Lamp bases. There's a case on that. Silverware designs, Transformer toys, cartoon characters, and even buildings may be protected by copyright protection. What I want you to take away from this is the understanding that you should be thinking very, very broadly in terms of what's protected. Derivative works and compilations are also protected, and those are legal terms, although they have plain, ordinary meanings as well. When I talk about a derivative work for purposes of copyright, I'm talking about, you know, Rocky III, or I'm talking about the Lord of the Rings movies. You know, when I was a kid, I read the Lord of the Rings books and the trilogy and The Hobbit, and then they were later made into movies. Well, the movies are what we call derivative works. The movies themselves are entitled to copyright protection, and they are based upon pre-existing works. So that's what a derivative work is. The authors can be, you know, within the meaning of the law, authors are broadly defined. A painter is an author, or a choreographer can be a writer within the meaning of copyright law. Just a little note there. What's not protected? Ideas, discoveries, facts, processes, systems, concepts, principles, those are not the subject matter of copyright. Copyright focuses on the actual expression that might disclose those facts or those discoveries. This is very, very critical, and it's critical for us as educators, and it's critical for everybody, because I can use someone else's ideas without asking permission, without seeking copyright, without reference to the copyright law. I can discuss their ideas, I can build upon their ideas, I can criticize their ideas, or praise their ideas. I can use facts which someone may have discovered for the first time. I don't have to ask permission to use those facts, and I'm able to use them, rely upon them, include them in my own articles, and that's because copyright law doesn't cover those things. Now, I may have an ethical duty to give credit for using those ideas or those facts, and that's a plagiarism sort of an issue and an ethical responsibility that I have, but that's not a copyright issue. And, you know, this is just fundamental and critical for copyright lawyers and for copyright law. Works in the public domain are not covered by copyright protection. And what I mean by public domain is probably something than what most of you have thought of when I said those words. Public domain are works, and I'm going to show some examples here. For example, works that predate copyright protection. The works of Shakespeare, for example, very old works of the old masters. At the time, they probably didn't seek copyright protection or may not have had it for some of the oldest works. And so those are in the public domain, meaning those works are works that anyone can use without a copyright problem if they're using the original works. Now, if you're using a new edition, something that someone's changed, added to, then that's a whole other matter, because that becomes a derivative work. And there can be protection for that derivative work. But if you're going back to the original, you know, Shakespeare play from who knows when, you don't have a copyright problem. Some copyrights have expired. So once there was a valid copyright, and now it's expired for various reasons. All copyrights expire sometime. The time frames have changed over the years, so it's a little bit difficult sometimes to pinpoint exactly when they expire. The current regime or scheme for copyright protection is based upon the life of the author plus 70 years. That's a little challenging because it is specific to the specific author who actually wrote or created the work. So you need to know how long they lived. Add 70 years, and that's how long the copyright is valid for. It wasn't too long ago, too many years ago, when we had set fixed terms. and those terms had to be renewed periodically. And if you didn't renew them, then you lost the copyright protection. And once you lost copyright protection, you couldn't reclaim it. So those kinds of works are in the public domain. So there are lots of works published prior to, I think, 1923 that are in the public domain because those copyrights would have expired. If the copyrights have expired, no issue with copyright law. You can use those works freely. Some works are in the public domain for failure to satisfy the requirements of copyright law. And this was more important under prior law, meaning before 1976. There were certain works created before 1976, and even some after 1976. There used to be a requirement that said you had to have a copyright notice on the work when it was published in order for there to be copyright protection. If you didn't put that copyright notice, meaning the circle C or the word copyright or an abbreviation of the word copyright, with the other information that was required, and you published it generally, then you lost copyright protection for that work. It was deemed to have been given to the public immediately, and so those works don't have protection. There is also a very important category of works, which are works of the United States government. Those works, there's a specific provision in the Copyright Act that says works of the United States government are not protected by copyright. The theory, I think, or the underlying policy would be that, you know, we are the government. I mean, we are the people. We paid for it in the first instance, and the government is promoting our good, and so they're not trying to sit on their works or lock up their works. And we are able to use government works without permission, without paying a royalty. Now, there is, but you have to be a little careful here, because we don't know what a work of the United States government is. And there is a definition in the Act, and it means works that are created by employees of the federal government within the scope of their employment. So if the government gives a grant to a researcher or to an entity to create something, that's a grant, and that's not a work of the United States government because those folks work for universities or for other entities. So even though government dollars paid for it, it's not a work of the United States government. There is a copyright in those kinds of works. But that is an important category of works. And frankly, there are lots of very good government documents and resources that get used. Many of our maps will be based upon U.S. Geological Survey maps that are created. And so the commercial map companies will take those government maps. They don't need permission. Then they'll add their own stuff, and then they'll sell those. So there's lots of good resources that are U.S. government works. And so those are some of the things that are outside the protection of copyright law. Now, I should mention before I move on that there are certain works that won't be considered original works. If I were to take an old work of, say, Shakespeare, for example, and to rewrite those verses and then put them out as my own, not only might I have an ethical problem, but I couldn't claim that that was an original work. So I can't claim a copyright if I were to republish those words. If I were to take a Shakespeare work and add my own commentary or notations, then there's new creative work that's original to me, the author. It doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be novel. But it has to be original with me. And then I can claim copyright protection to the extent of those additions, whatever additional creative content I added. So there are some things that might be deemed not to have enough originality to qualify for copyright protection, but that's a fairly slim amount of works. What I'm telling you is, you know, as we sit here today, if you were to draw a little, you know, a little figure on a piece of paper, a doodle, or if you were to write a few lines of poetry, the minute you do that, it's protected. You don't need to file for anything. You don't need to put any notices on it. It's protected. It's original with you, and it's fixed in a tangible medium of expression. It's written on a piece of paper. So, again, we have to think very broadly in terms of what's protected and what's not. When I talk about misconceptions that I try and correct, some people still believe, and this used to be true, again, that if you don't have a circle C on it, that it's not protected. And so obviously that's not the case today. Some students in particular have the misconception that if it's on the internet, that's the public domain because it's publicly accessible, that it can be freely used and that it's out there for the public. That is not correct. Those things often have copyright protection, and so we should always assume there is protection unless we have a reason to know that there's not. What rights does a copyright holder have? A copyright holder has the right to reproduce the work, has the right to prepare derivative works, to distribute copies to the public, to perform the work publicly, and to display the work publicly. And when I say has the right, I mean has the exclusive right to do those things. In other words, if, you know, I found an article that I like, and I make a dozen copies, well, then we have a question about whether or not I have violated the author's exclusive right to make reproductions of that article. So that's where that comes in. If I take a movie and I play a movie at an auditorium where I invite the public, I've just publicly performed a work that's protected by copyright, and that's a copyright violation. That's a problem. So these are the exclusive rights that a copyright owner has. You see the right to prepare derivative works. That means if you write a novel, I can't take that novel and create a movie based on the novel without your permission, or else there's a copyright problem. You're the only one who has the right to allow someone to create works based upon your novel. And it comes up in very interesting ways, because sometimes people will read a novel and say, you know, I love those Star Wars characters, but I could write a great Star Wars novel with Luke Skywalker and all those other folks. And so they'll think that they can write a new novel, and maybe they could write a good novel. But even if they're not repeating any text from an earlier book, if they're using those characters are well enough delineated that they're subject to copyright protection, and that person has violated the derivative works right, and there's a copyright problem. So those are the exclusive rights that a copyright holder has. This may be a good time to remind you all, and we'll come to this again, that if I have permission from the copyright holder, all is well. So I can do any of these things if I have permission from the copyright holder. They have the right to authorize me. If they've done it, things are good. And so that's something we look for. Now, if we don't have permission, then we have to look for other things in the law that would allow us to use the works in certain ways. And we'll talk about some of those in a moment. Concerns for universities and colleges. I just made a list of some things that I was aware of that might be concerns to you, or that I was aware of because I'm in private higher education myself. And here's a list of some things that came to mind. Music copying and other file sharing. Of course, this is particularly of interest to our students, many of whom were sort of raised in a generation where a lot of that happened, free music sharing on peer-to-peer networks. And now we're experiencing some movies, DVDs that are being shared as well. We'll talk about that. Public performances. That's a big issue for us if you're in the fine arts, for example, and we have recitals, or if we are in theater and we do productions. And so that can be an area of interest to us that has copyright implications. Classroom use of content. If I have a classroom and I hand out articles, or I hand out chapters of books, or I hand out pictures or photographs that I have that I've gotten from the internet or from other books, that raises an issue of copyright. Online use of content. And this can be this can come up in various ways. Online use of content might be in a materials management system that we have available to us. It might be in an online course. And there can be some different things that govern those different contexts. It might be that I have my own website and I throw things up on the website. All of those things raise some copyright questions if I'm using other people's material, or if I'm posting other people's material. Student use of content is an issue. They do projects, and a lot of times they do great projects that might include some music, and they might try and include some video and other things. Library copies for things like electronic reserves, or maybe they do backup copies of works. Well, they're making reproductions, so there's questions there. One final thing I added, because as faculty members, it's just sort of an interesting sideshow, but there is an issue, too, about for faculty members, who owns those works that you create if you're working full-time for the college. They're paying your salary. You're doing it on college. You're using the college's computers, support staff. Who exactly owns that work? Is that a work that you own personally, or does the college have an interest in it? That's something that gets discussed a little bit. Now, I'll just tell you briefly, most institutions have a policy that they allow their instructors to have the copyright in those things, and there's sort of an accepted, in the business, there's an accepted notion, some might even say it's kind of a common law doctrine or tradition that faculty members would own rights to their own scholarship. It gets, so that would be a general view, not necessarily, but not necessarily true, so it would be worth thinking about. It's different when we talk about patent law. It becomes a big issue at research institutions where we have researchers, full-time employees of the educational institutions who are coming up with some really good, interesting stuff that gets patented and who has the patent interests. And that's beyond what we're going to talk about today. But it is an area of worth thinking about. I thought we'd start with talking about music and movie copying. What is peer-to-peer or other file sharing? That was sort of the Napster, Grokster age when students and our children and others were sharing songs freely amongst each other. And that I posed the question, what's the copyright problem with free sharing of music? Oh, it's a huge copyright problem. It's a huge copyright problem because what happens is instead of someone having to go buy the music on a CD or on a record in the old days, we said records in the old days, right? I had a very funny story about one of my kids several years ago said to me something about, "Dad, didn't CDs used to be these big black things that had music on them?" I'm not kidding. I thought that was the funniest thing ever. Yeah, they did used to be these big black things that had music on them. How time flies, right? What's the copyright problem with this peer-to-peer file sharing? The problem is that people, students, all of us, whoever did it, could get a copy that was a perfect copy of the song and not pay a dime for it, which means the copyright holder wasn't getting any benefit from that sharing. And it was replacing sales of the copyrighted works. So, you know, when you buy a CD or you buy a song, in theory, the copyright owner is getting some piece of that, and that's how they're making their living, and that's what's supporting them so they can continue to create and all of those things. If we're doing free file sharing, their sales are way down, they're not getting compensated, and we take away that incentive the copyright law was there for. And so the law is quite clear that that kind of file sharing, as a general proposition, is a violation of the copyright law. And in fact, the courts have shut down some of those sites and made it more difficult and has gone after students who have been big downloaders and continues to do that. So that's an area with file sharing. Now, there are a very few circumstances where peer-to-peer file sharing might not be a violation of copyright law, but it's very few kinds of things. Things, and I can give you some examples. It would be something like some bands, for example, would put their music out because they wanted to get their name out. They weren't big names. They didn't have a big record label to promote them. And so they found this as a way to get their music out there so they could create a market and create a name for themselves. Well, essentially, they were giving permission, they had no objection, so essentially they're giving a license to allow that to be shared. That was a small, probably, amount of what was being shared. Another example might be some limited file sharing where I was, using it under the fair use exception. Maybe I was using a small clip of some music. That could potentially have been allowable. But vast majority of the file sharing that occurred was a violation of copyright law and is, as that still continues today. There's also a problem I put here, DMCA problems. That stands for Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was a separate act that amended the big Copyright Act in recent years that prohibits us from circumventing encryption or going around security devices that are on DVDs, for example, that are intended to protect the digital content. So if, you know, if I'm a movie company and I know that people are sharing my movies freely and it's preventing me from making the sales, then I put on protection. I encrypt it so that you have to have the encryption device to decrypt so that they can't copy it freely or share it freely. Well, of course, it didn't take long before sort of enterprising folks broke the encryption and they were passing around the code to decrypt stuff. Now, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says it's a violation of the law for you to circumvent that encryption and then copy that digital conduct content. And so we have to deal with that also. Public performance. This right, I've been referring a little bit to reproduction right. When you make copies of music, that violates the reproduction right that a copyright holder has. In education, we worry very much about public performance of works as well. And a public performance is quite broadly defined. To perform a work means to recite, render, play, dance, or act it, either directly or by means of any device or process, or in the case of a motion picture or other audiovisual work, to show its image in any sequence or to make the sounds accompanying it audible. That means I perform the work when I read a poem in my classroom. That's a performance, and it's a public performance. There's a definition for what's public, by the way, but if you do it in your home, you're okay, usually. But if you do it to a group beyond your circle of friends or your family, that would be considered a public performance. If I play a song in my class, that's a public performance. If I sing a song in my class, that's a public performance. If I play a video clip, that would be a public performance. So this is an important area to us as teachers. Now, I'm going to tell you in just a minute that there are exceptions that help us as teachers that allow us to do those things in many circumstances. But we have to be aware of what it means and make sure that we qualify for an exception that would permit us to do these things. Music recitals, plays, movies that we show, poetry that we might recite, songs from CDs, radios over speakers, playing the radio over a speaker, that's a performance. We're performing that radio show. Television playing in a commons area. Well, when we turn on the television, that's a public performance. So we need to qualify for an exception, or we need to get permission to do those things. Many colleges and universities will have sought and obtained a license to allow them to use music at their events. So, I mean, I can't speak to your institution. I'm sure you probably do. But Creighton, for example, we have a license that allows us to use music, just like a radio station might play music. It's the same, actually the same organizations issuing those licenses. We pay a set fee every year. It allows us to play music at events, and that's how we do it. So we're getting permission to do that. There is something called the fair use exception, which to me, I call it the mother of all exceptions. It's huge. It's the big one. And we love the fair use exception. It's important. It's critical to all of us. The theory of the fair use exception is that there are certain uses of copyrighted works that should be permitted by the law without having to seek permission from the owner. And one theory was that if you had asked for permission, it would have been given because it was such a modest use or such an innocuous use that more likely than not, the copyright holders would say, oh yeah, sure, fine, no problem. And the reason we don't require you to go and ask them is there's transaction costs and problems. If you had to ask every time you were using any small amount of some work, very burdensome, and what would happen is you wouldn't do it, and it would impoverish your classroom experience and your use of these works. So the idea, again, is that the copyright holder a reasonable copyright holder would have allowed you to use it without compensation in that circumstance. And so this is considered a fair use. Now, that doesn't mean we have to ask a particular copyright holder, would you or wouldn't you have allowed this? Because even the cranky ones, if the exception applies, can't say, oh, no, I don't consent. Doesn't matter. If the fair use exception applies, we're good to go. And I guess the other part of it is it's sort of a safety valve, because there are certain things that the law deems should be permitted. And in this way, the monopoly that a copyright holder has over their expression is limited. There are certain uses that we will allow you to make of it that they wouldn't have allowed. The fair use of a copyrighted work for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, including multiple copies for classroom use, scholarship, or research is not an infringement of copyright. Again, that sounds very good to us as teachers in particular. It sounds like it gives us a green light for all these things. But it's, the language of the statute is clear. It continues and says, and you must consider these four factors, even if it is for teaching, or even if it is for criticism or scholarship, you still have to consider these four factors. And then we come to these four factors. I'm going a little long here, so I should speed up. Sorry. The first factor is purpose and character of the use. The focus here is, well, is it for a commercial purpose that I'm using the work, someone else's work, or a non-commercial purpose? And, of course, educational, non-profit educational purposes, they're golden. They're the best. They're great. Or for personal, nonprofit personal use is good too. If I'm using it for a nonprofit educational purpose, that's good, and that would cause this factor to tend in my direction. But it's not the end of the inquiry by any means. If it's a commercial use, that would cut against this factor, or this, that would suggest that it's probably not a fair use, or it cuts against a finding of fair use. Let me put it that way. There are other things to consider under this factor. Is it being used for purposes of comment, discussion, or criticism? You know, we sometimes have things that we use in our classroom or in an educational setting that are not really germane to the education. It's just sort of, just kind of fun, make it a fun environment, something like that. So that might be roughly an educational use, but it's not going to get the benefit of this so much. But if it's being used in class for discussion purposes, to educate and enlighten the students, or for criticism or comment, that's a good thing. And I have something here called transformative use. If you're adding to it, you're adding to the knowledge, you're adding to the learning, which works really well for us in education, then that's a favored kind of a use. Now, the second factor, nature of the copyrighted work, is something we have to evaluate. If it is a factual or a historical type of a work, that's good in terms of seeking fair use. If it is a fiction, a work of fiction, then it's entitled to greater protection, and that would be less good for us if we're seeking to use it. If it's an unpublished work, say it's a manuscript that has not been published yet, that gets higher protection, and so we're less likely to qualify for fair use. If it's already published and been out there, then that's helpful. If it's a consumable work, by that we mean something like workbooks that are published for use in classrooms. Now, I don't know what your experience is here, particularly though in my kids' classrooms, for example, in elementary school or in middle school. Or it used to be that, you know, they might all have a workbook. They would, you know, fill them out, and then you threw them away when you're done. They were graded and thrown away. Well, if they're workbooks, it's very different. We don't allow you just to take that workbook and copy 30 copies and hand them out to the students, because essentially you're replacing the sale of that workbook. So consumables that way are less likely to get the are less likely to qualify for fair use. Out of print works are more likely to qualify for fair use, because the argument is, I couldn't purchase it, so the only way for me to really make good use of it is to allow me to do some copying or to use it in this way. Third factor, amount and substantiality of the portion of the copyrighted work used. The more of the work you use, the less likely it is that you will qualify for the fair use exception. the less of the work you use, then the better your chances are. So when you write an article, if it's very common, you might quote a sentence or even a paragraph from someone else's article or book. You don't usually need to ask for permission to do that because you're using a small portion of their protected work. And the smaller the better. If in your book or in your article you use a page or two pages of someone else's article or text, well then, less likely that you're going to qualify for fair use, and you probably do need to get permission for that kind of a use. There's also a qualitative aspect to the amount of the work that you use, which is to say, then there's case law on this, if you have captured the best or most significant parts of the copyrighted work and reproduced those, even though maybe, you know, counting word for word or page for page, you didn't use that much, if you took the highlights or the best parts, then that may be considered a substantial portion of the copyrighted work that you're using. So that may cut against finding a fair use. And the final factor is the effect upon the potential market for or the value of the copyrighted work. And this all ties back to the incentive issue. Are we undercutting the market that the copyright holder has for his or her work? And if we are, then that's problematic. If we aren't, then it's more likely that we qualify for finding a fair use. Fair use, a single copy for scholarship, for teaching, or for preparation for class. If we're talking about an article or a poem or a short work, no problems generally. It's just for purposes of scholarship. We're not handing it out. It's just for our own scholarly purposes. Multiple copies for classroom use can be allowed in some cases, but we have to go through the fair use factors. And if we use it every semester, there's going to be a problem. If we're handing out an article every semester because it may be undercutting the author's market for their article, if it is a news item that showed up on the news this week and I want to just get it out to my students this time, then I may have a fair use claim, so I can do that because it's the timeliness. I didn't really have time to think about it, to get permissions, and it's short. Just getting it, I'm doing it this time. If I were to use it in future semesters, I might need to go get permission. No to course packs. This was a big deal some years ago where faculty members would say, well, I don't need a textbook, but I'll take a chapter from this book, and I'll take an article here and an article here and a news article here. We'll put them all together. We'll send them to the copy center and say, just get that pack. That is generally not going to qualify as a fair use and would be problematic because we're often taking too much of the copyrighted work and we're not paying them for it. We're replacing sales of texts. We're replacing royalties that need to be paid for authors of those articles. Now, I'm not saying that never, but most likely that would be a problem. Check your publisher's permissions. Publishers will often, if you adopt their book, a lot of times they'll provide guidelines and they'll say, we consider this fair use. So they might allow you to make copies of certain materials freely and they give you that permission. If they'll give you permission, you're good. So look for their published guidelines and their permissions and you can contact them and ask them questions and they often will be helpful to you if you've adopted their book and you're using it. Course materials. Check licenses that you might have. And is it available in your library? Let me mention what I'm after here. When we talk about fair use and undercutting the market that the copyright holder might have, if my students have the right to access that material in the library, let's say the library has a license that allows any of our students to download or to access that article electronically, then I, as a faculty member, I can put in a link to that spot. They already have, doesn't undercut the market that the copyright holder might have for that work because it's already, they already have permission to do it through a license that we already have in place. And so I can just refer them to the library link and tell them to get it that way. And that should be something that shouldn't be a problem in most cases. certainly makes it more likely that it would qualify as fair use, because it's not usually undercutting the market that they have. If you should not circumvent the security devices, so you shouldn't remove those protections on a DVD so that you can take a clip of the DVD and use it, because that could violate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. In some ways, it's as if it were in a paper context. You know, if you could have handed it out in class to your students, then you can probably post it. But you need to be careful about one thing, and that is not allowing it to be multiplied, not allowing it to be freely accessed by people outside of your classroom, and not allowing your students to send or forward copies of that material to others, because it's a little different than handing out a hard copy in your class. Check your contracts in the library. You know, if you have a database that allows you to have access to all these articles, see what the contracts say, and it may be that they've given you permission to use that freely among your students. So look at that. I also look at journals. In the law, in the legal area, we have law reviews, and they have legal articles. Often in the law reviews, in the front, there will be a license that says anyone's free to use this for educational nonprofit purposes. So the license will be right there in the book. Other times, we'll contact them directly and ask them for permission. And for those kinds of publications, they're pretty generous and will allow us to do that in lots of cases. In terms of library use, one thing that libraries have to struggle with sometimes is limiting access to those databases that they have, because you can't have a non-student that can freely access your electronic database and download those articles for free, because that's often outside the scope of your contracts. And librarians know that. I will mention now, this is probably the point to mention, librarians tend to be some of the most knowledgeable people on campus about copyright restrictions, and they're very careful about these things. I'm not saying that they don't want to hear all your questions, and I mean, they don't want you to treat them like they are your lawyers, but they are very knowledgeable and can be very helpful in these areas. Let's see. Public performance and display rights. I mentioned the public performance rights a minute ago, but these are some exceptions. There's a specific exception in the Copyright Act for performance of non-dramatic literary or musical works without commercial purpose, without pay to the performers or the institution, and there's no admission charge. So when a student does a recital, a music recital that's free, they're playing, you know, they're playing a musical work, that's a public performance of the work. Well, it most likely qualifies under this exception, so that's how we do that without paying. However, if it's a dramatic work, you're performing a play in the theater, that doesn't qualify for this exception, and they do pay royalties for those kinds of works. Classroom teaching exception. There's another exception specific to classroom teachers that now again, this is not talking about copying. It's not talking about the right to make reproductions. It's focusing on the right to perform or display a work. This exception says, performance or display of a work by instructors or pupils in the course of face-to-face teaching activities of a nonprofit educational institution in a classroom or similar place devoted to instruction is not a violation of the performance or display rights. So it's a very important exception to us. That's how come you can read poetry in your class, or a student can read poetry, or you can perform a piece of music, or you might be able to play a short video clip in your class, and you would do it under this exception. Very important exception for us in education. We're getting near the end here. I'm sorry, I'm going a little bit long. Student use of materials. A lot of what students do is probably fair use, and a lot of that probably works. Now, there are some problems. Facebook things. If they're going on the internet and finding things and posting things on their Facebook, well, you know, that's a nonprofit use, but they are using people's images or other people's intellectual property, and you know, in theory, there could be some problems there. So they shouldn't just be posting any old thing that might be copyright protected. They could be violating the law in some cases. They obviously use it in projects. Sometimes that could be fair use. But if they use too much of it, they might exceed the fair use exception. There is a separate and a very important issue of plagiarism, and I referred to that a little bit earlier. That is an ethical issue. Sometimes plagiarism is also a copyright violation, but sometimes it's not a copyright violation, but it's still an ethical problem. So that's a separate issue. I've put here a few resources you might look to. One is the Copyright Office itself, the United States Copyright Office itself. They have a website, and it's actually got lots of very good information. It has frequently asked questions. It has, you can search for copyrights. A lot of really good stuff there. And that is at copyright.gov. There is also another website at Columbia University that sort of focuses on academics and their questions and issues with copyright law. It's a fairly recent website, but they have some really good people that participate and work with that website. So copyright.columbia.edu can be a resource. The library groups often have some really good copyright information, too, that apply to us in education. The American Library Association and the Association of Research Libraries, both of them may have some good resources for you to look at. One thing I didn't mention, and I should do this as I close, is that there is the Copyright Clearinghouse Center. They have a big website as well. They have a lot of good information, too. They are a group that facilitate requesting permissions to use copyrighted works and paying for it. So a lot of times, if you're going to use an article in a course pack, you can go to the Copyright Clearinghouse Center and see if it's in their library or ask them, and they will help you get permissions for that. And it'll tell you. A lot of times you can go in. If it's in their library already, you can see exactly how much per page it's going to cost you, and you can figure out what the cost will be immediately, and you can get instant permission online. Others, you might have to request, and they have to do a little bit of work, and they'll help you get the permissions. So that's the Copyright Clearinghouse Center, and they have some good resources available. Now, if you're in a situation where you're seeking permissions, you can certainly use the Copyright Clearinghouse site. You can also go directly to the copyright holder if you know who that is. And that often is very good. Sometimes when they know who you are, they'll say, no problem. You know, you can use it. Just make sure you get it in writing so that you have it for your records and get those permissions. And it can be very helpful. Other times they'll not be as helpful, but they can it can work. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me today.
You've been listening to a program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard a lecture by Craig Dallin, Associate Dean and Professor of Law at Creighton University. His topic was Copyrights and Free Use. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, December 12, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Carmen Steele, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.